right. Just as a sound check, name, place of birth, date of birth, whatever.
Sure. Name is Patrick Gruby. Place of birth was Seedburg, Wisconsin, and was born in 1986.
I think I'm doing that the right way. Yep, there we go. All right. I guess maybe start with just, can you tell me, you mentioned when we first met that you had, you'd been on deployment in the Pacific, and then you guys got a call about North Korea starting something, so you sat off the coast for a little bit. Can you tell me just kind of what happened and what you did?
Sure.
Off the coast?
I can do that. You want me to go into my military history first, so it's on record?
If you want to, sure.
Sure, I can just, I was in the Navy for 5 years. I was stationed on the USS Russell, which is a guided missile destroyer that was stationed out of Pearl Harbor. So I did 4 deployments. I missed the 5th one by about 3 days. But the Navy deployments are anything over 90 days away from home port. So if you're actually stationed off the coast of your home port for over 90 days, you can technically receive a deployment ribbon for it. But in regards to your question, on our first deployment we did, it was meant to be just like a Southeastern Asia deployment. And we kind of went to Singapore and Thailand, a couple other visits over there just for more presence and just make sure that coastal waters are safe and there's no issues with them. And within about 12 days from us returning to home port, we actually briefly stopped in Guam on our way home, which is about a week, about 10 days away. And about 2 days after that, we got the message and the call from our commanding authority to head up to Japan for some repairs, and that we were most likely going to get stationed off the coast of Korea's, because one of the primary missions of my ship was ballistic missile defense, which all that means is our ship was fully capable of shooting down any type of missile that was launched from any type of land facility or ship in the vicinity of it. So, and even if we couldn't shoot it down, we could actually target it and send the track of the missile and the trajectory of it to another land-based facility, and they could shoot it down. So for our overall mission, we went to Japan for a couple days. I think we actually spent the 4th of July in there, if I remember correctly. And then from there, we went to the coast of the Koreas, and we interacted with a little bit of the South Koreans. And my ship at the time was one of the few ballistic missile defense ships that was in this fleet that were certified to do that. We kind of got that because we were one of the test platforms before they kind of rolled out this whole entire BMD ships to all the Aegis class ships. So from there, we went from Japan, went down to Korea. Normally have a cruising speed, but we went there kind of with a mission and a purpose. So we went pretty quick, and we're just kind of stationed off the coast of it and just monitoring it in case they were to launch something, because at the time they were threatening to shoot missiles at Hawaii. And that's kind of gives you a lot of meaning and purpose, especially when all your families are back there. For me, my family was still back here in Wisconsin, but a lot of the other guys, their children and wives and all that were living there in Hawaii. So everyone kind of does take it seriously. And we're just kind of off the coast for a couple weeks. And then they're able to get another ship that was stationed out of Japan to kind of relieve us. And go from there. So then we kind of went with the Kitty Hawk strike group, and we went down to Australia and went to Singapore again, and then we came back to Hawaii. But we extended another 2.5 months off the original deployment. So,
all right. And kind of going off that, have you ever had to do stuff like that? Have there been other times where you've been called in because there have been threats of missiles being shot?
The ship I was on actually did get kind of pulled a lot of different ways with that. Some things off the record, we were stationed in areas. Other ones, we were kind of off the Koreas. Kind of pretty much any time you think that they're going to shoot missiles, They'd have at least one or two ships like mine or my ship off the coast there. So, I mean, we were off there probably two or three times. But, I mean, we really weren't stationed out there for a lot of months on end. Those kind of went to, like, the Japanese ships or the U.S. ships that were stationed in Japan because it's a little bit more accessible to them because they're right there. So they can kind of do the whole rotation and kind of get that down. And they're called, like, our forward deployed Navy. So where Hawaii is kind of on the verge of it because we're closer to that, but they're not really going to deploy a lot of California-based ships to go off there because it's just too costly to pay for all the fuel and the manpower to do it. So we did have a couple other ones where we were like in the Mediterranean doing scenarios with it in case other countries were to shoot missiles, and we would be like to intercept stuff for going if a missile were shot at like Israel. So we'd actually be between it, and we kind of had a couple scenarios where we made it like a country would shoot a missile and another ship that was off the coast of that one would monitor it, and they'd actually pass that fake missile track to us and we'd actually shoot it down. So that was one of the reasons that we went through the Suez Canal three times, was to do that, because most of the time they don't send Pacific ships through the Suez Canal. But since our mission, that what we could do on the Russell, it kind of put us in that scenario, so that was kind of cool. It's also really interesting seeing all the armed guards line the coastals, or like the whole sand dunes and everything of it.
Right. I don't know, can you maybe talk a little more about like the ship in and of itself, what you guys generally do if you don't get calls out for missiles?
Sure. I mean, most destroyers, they're kind of like a jack of all trades. The one I was on was a USS Russell, and they call it a Flight 1 destroyer, which you have a Flight 1 and a Flight 2. I think they might actually have a Flight 3 now, but it's just called like versions of it. The Flight 1s were the basic, they call them the Arleigh Burke destroyers. So the hull number of mine was 59. I think Arleigh Burke was 54, or it was in the early 50s for the numbering. And each year they would produce so many of them. So we were one of the earlier ones that was made. So the main difference between the Flight 1 and the Flight 2s was that the Flight 2s actually had a permanent helicopter bay on it, and they actually had two helos that were on board at all times, where my ship, we didn't have any helicopter hangar. We just had a landing pad where one could land. So we were kind of limited with some things we could do, but overall we had almost more missile capacity than the Flight 2s did. And for other things, I mean, if you look at them, they look very similar, same radar systems and everything. It's, they got a couple upgrades like for some of the weaponry, but I mean, we're still able to do just about everything as the newer versions of them. So, but the primary purpose of the destroyers are, I mean, back in World War II, they're kind of like anti-subs things, and you could still provide some type of munitions for like a shore-based support, like firing guns and stuff on there. But now the destroyer's kind of taken on a new role where they can hold all different types of missiles. We can hold missiles that they call them VLAs, or vertical launch ASROCs, which are torpedoes essentially with a booster on the back. So we could launch torpedoes like 60 miles out of the ocean and target a sub out there. We can do a lot of anti-submarine warfare because we do have sonar on our ship. We're also, like, we can do air control. Like, we have missiles that target aircraft, and we also have shore-based stuff. We can launch Tomahawks from my ship. We can actually launch torpedoes from a torpedo tube, and we have a 5-inch gun on the front, which can either target aircraft or it can target land-based stuff as well, or another ship's. We also do have anti-ship missiles, which are on the middle part of the ship. So, I mean, just about any type of thing you could think of, destroyers can do about it. The only thing is we don't really have, like I said, helicopters there. So if we are limited, but most of the time we do go out with the carrier strike group. So they do have helicopters, which they can provide assistance for us. But I mean, the last deployment I did was we were guarding an oil platform in Iraq. And we were the only ship in the coalition group because we worked with a French frigate and a British frigate, and the Coast Guard, like U.S. Coast Guard, which was stationed out there, but none of them had anti-air capabilities. So we were pretty much the primary anti-air, like radar, and we'd have to kind of manage and see if people were coming in, because that one oil platform generated 90% of the income for Iraq. So it's called ABOT, and they have like four super tankers that are strapped to it. And within 2 to 4 days, they'd rotate out another one. And then they fill up that one and they send another one off, and just a whole routine. So, but that was primarily the purpose of the destroyers. It's, you can do just about everything, which is kind of cool. But at the same time, you, like with the carrier, our ship only had about 300 people on it. So for sending us into shallower waters, the carriers couldn't go. Or for doing other missions, we could detach from the carrier strike group and they could pretty much tell us to do whatever they wanted us to do, which we didn't really have much say because our commanding officer is only like a commander. It's an O5 where carriers have an admiral on board, or if you're with a destroyer squadron, you normally have a captain that is your, can't think of the name of it, Commodore. And he's the one that normally resides on a cruiser, which is a little bit larger ship than mine. So they kind of boss us around, and we just kind of get stuck doing all the brunt work of it. So, but another primary mission of the destroyer is at nighttime where they do flight ops, which they'll use our mast lights to help land the aircraft, because the carrier and our ship pretty much have all lights turned off for safety reasons. So they actually go right off our mast lights, which we have two red lights on there, and they go off the carrier lights so that way they can determine where the carrier's at. And they pretty much are just flying overhead about maybe 200 feet, and then they hit their afterburners full bore, and you're actually on the bridge wing, you can actually feel the heat on your face and the roar of it. So it's pretty exciting, but it's one of the other purposes that we do. So.
All right. I personally am also just curious about enlistment, kind of like what you go through, like when you first enlist, and then, you know, the whole process of getting assigned to groups, like, do you have a choice or?
Sure. I mean, I can give you like my personal take on it, what happened to me. I can give a little bit of what the Navy has, but it varies and it might have changed by now. Mm-hmm. So like for me, I actually joined my senior year of high school. So I was going into my senior year and I was 17 and I didn't turn 18 until my birthday, which was in August. But the Navy had it where they were to guarantee a job. So when I went to the Navy recruiters, I was like, here's kind of what I want to do. And they're like, well, here's some occupations that you could pick. If you went to the Air Force at the time, which I did, they said, well, here's a field that you can pick from, which was like electronics. So you would join that field and they would determine what job they needed you at. So you didn't really have that much of a say in it. And the Army was also really specific. You could pretty much pick your occupation. And Marines, I didn't really look at, but I assume it's probably similar to the Navy because they are our little baby brothers, which whether they like it or not, that's how it works. You always say that you drop your high school buddies off for playtime because they don't have their licenses. So we have to be like the mom and dad figure and we just drop them off for playtime. So, but for the enlistment purposes of it, so I joined my senior year. I was 17, so I actually had to have my parents sign with it. And then from there, I went to boot camp, which was that following July. So I had a year, they call it a delayed entry program, or DEP for short. Military always loves abbreviating everything. So from DEP, I just pretty much, it was once a month, I'd have to report to the recruiter's office and just make a couple meetings, and then I'd have to do like a physical training regiment like twice a year, and just so that they knew I was in physical standards. Then once July came around, I went down to Milwaukee and signed all my paperwork officially, and then went to boot camp and stayed at boot camp from July. Recruiters actually picked me up on July 4th. And then July 5th, I started boot camp, and then that went to August 26th for us. It kind of varies. They say, I think it's like an 8-week boot camp, but it can go anywhere from like 10 to 7 weeks. They really kind of have to, they kind of shorten if they need to, as long as you kind of meet your general criteria. So from boot camp, then I was fortunate where I actually had a job, and those are picked up. Some people went in as, like, they call them undesignated. And those guys will go straight to the fleet for the most part, and they're doing more bosun mate jobs, which are kind of like a lot of preservation, like sanding, painting, a lot of grunt work with it. And then they say, well, you can choose a job like about 2 years after you're on the ship, so you can cross right into something. So those guys kind of are at a disadvantage because they're doing the job that really no one wants to do, and then they can pick their job later on, but I already had a job and everything, so I was kind of fortunate with that. So for me, I went from boot camp, I went to ITA school, which actually was right across the street in Great Lakes. As Navy calls it, Great Mistakes. That's where our boot camp is also. And from there, went through my A school training, which went to about mid-December. And during the time of that I was there, there's two ways of doing it. You can fill out, they call them a dream sheet, which dream sheets generally have like three or four options that you can put on where you want to go stationed or what type of ship you want to do. And then from there, they determine what the Navy needs and they kind of pick from there. I've never really heard anyone getting picked their first choice unless it's a place that really is in demand. But generally people aren't going to put their, they're not going to pick Iraq, Afghanistan for their number one choice. They're going to pick like, say like Naples, Italy, or Sigonella, Sicily, or Rota, Spain, or some of these other places that are really nice. And not really in direct combat, but maybe people will choose otherwise. But for me, I was fortunate where they actually had one of the recruiters, or detailers they call them when you're actually in, the detailers came to our school for ITA school, and she would just assign IT's positions in the Navy, like where to go. So it broke our class into graduating class, like such as GPA, like what was your highest grades, but before the GPA, they went as fleet returnees because some guys actually were other jobs and they came back to ITA school for retraining, but they've been in the Navy for, some of them were in the Navy for like 8 or 9 years already, and they're just switching over to an IT job. So they got first picks, and then it went down into your grades for that class. So I picked right around fifth. When I sat down with the detailer, she was, a senior chief, which would be an E9, or actually E8, sorry. She said, well, we have all these ships open. And I was like, well, I kind of want to do both jobs of my, both aspects of my job, which part of it was communication, part of it was computers, and I kind of want to do both, where if I went on a carrier, generally you're assigned just one side of it. So you either be picked as a communication person, so you're just running radios, or you're running just the computer stuff, like working with the local area network and stuff. Well, I kind of want to do both, so I was like, I wanted to go on like a smaller ship, as they call them, small boys. And she's like, well, we have a, she really tried pushing me to go to Japan because they needed people there. And she said, well, you can go to Essex and all these other like amphibious ships over there. And I was like, I really don't want to go to Japan. And I was like, well, what do you have for like the smaller ships or something? And she's like, well, we have a destroyer out of Pearl Harbor. I was like, absolutely. Like, I didn't even hesitate. I was like, yes, because I've never been to Hawaii and never saw the ocean or anything. So I was like, that would be a great, great duty station, and it's nice and warm, quite contrary to Wisconsin life. And yeah, so that's how I picked that. Other guys, other people in the class, were assigned, some of them picked shore duty in Naples, Italy. Another person picked a Hilo squadron for an admiral out of San Diego. One guy picked Keflavik, Iceland, which is shore duty, which they had one up there and they since then closed it down. A couple other guys picked carriers, and I think there was maybe one other person that got a destroyer, but that was about it. It didn't have many positions on there, so. But that was kind of how that worked for picking the duty stations and stuff. You kind of pick your ship and they tell you where it's at and go from there. And when you're actually in the fleet and you're actually like on the ship, like towards the end there, when I was thinking about maybe reenlisting, I was contacting the detailer, and you can actually go on websites and they show all the positions that they have open. And Navy does it depending on what your job is. They have a sea to shore rotation. So for an IT, it's generally 5 and 3 or 5 and 2, depending on what your pay grade is at the time. So I was an E5, so I think it was about 5 and 3 at the time. So generally you do 5 years out at sea, and then you do 3 years at shore duty, which shore duty, you're on like an installation, and you can do like recruiting, except if you're in IT, then they don't really let you do that, or they don't let you do RDC, which is a drill instructor. So for me, I was looking, they had positions open in Signal Sicily, which for shore duty, and that was with my NEC, which was like my schooling. MOS is what the Army calls it. Navy calls it NEC, which is Naval something. Can't think of it right now. Drawn a blank. But anyways, I tried asking the detailer to send me there, and they're like, no, it's too costly to send one person from Hawaii to Signal Sicily. And I told them, well, you don't have to send any of my stuff. Like, honestly, you can send my car back home. Like, just send me. And they still said no. And then I said, well, let me go somewhere closer to Wisconsin so I can be closer to their family. And they said, I can't go recruiting, so I couldn't do that. I couldn't push boots at Great Lakes. And they said that I could either stay in Hawaii, or I could get sent to somewhere on the West Coast, and I really didn't want to go there. So I asked them, like, well, what would it take for me to go to Signal Sicily? And they said, well, you have to take a one-year individual augmentee, or they call it IA, to Iraq or Afghanistan, and then you'd get first pick next time up. And I was like, well, I already did four deployments two to the Persian Gulf and everything. It's like, I was kind of at my end's wit with being deployed, and I wanted some downtime because I was getting burnt out from it. And the detailer is like, well, that's the only way to get there to Signal Sicily. And I said, well, look at my other options, and now I'm here in Madison. So that was all procedures for that. I don't know if that answered your question.
Definitely. And I'm still a little curious about getting out of the Navy, kind of the process of getting out. What organizations can you go to for help or whatever?
Sure. The transition out of the military is it's not a really easy one. I wish that they would kind of look at it a little bit more, and they are recently, but it has been kind of overlooked. Like, you have like an 8-week boot camp, which essentially they take a civilian and make you into like a military person that is great at taking orders and very rigid and structured, and you like things certain ways and you can follow directions. And for the processing out, you're lucky if you do get, they call it TAPS, which is Transition Assistance Program. And if you don't get TAPS, essentially they can run you right to your last day and they discharge you. So you go from military life to civilian life with no transition at all, no education or anything like that. So they do have TAPS, which is generally like a week course or maybe 10 days. I actually was fortunate where I was able to do it, but I really had to like almost pull teeth from people because I was actually forward deployed to the Persian Gulf when I was ready to get out. So when I was at the time, I was like, all right, I have leave that was built up over the time and like in my service, and I didn't use it all, so I can use that at the very end to kind of give myself roughly a month off, and I could transition back home here to Wisconsin, and I still would be getting paid. So that was kind of nice. But like for me, when I was out at sea, essentially people were just kind of like, if you didn't do anything yourself, like they weren't gonna help you because they had all their other jobs to do. So when I was telling them, like, I need to move my vehicle, I need to get all my stuff shipped out of Hawaii, and we're sitting here in the Persian Gulf, like I can't do it from there. And you have to check out with my landlord and like do all my lease stuff and get all checked out of my apartment. And they're like, well, okay. They're like, well, are you gonna send me back? And like, well, you can do it on your leave time. I was like, that's not fair to make sure that I have to do everything on my leave time when, like, if I wasn't on leave, I would be able to do it then and there while, like, throughout the day because I still be running errands and stuff. So I finally was able to talk to some people, and they're like, okay, well, we'll send you back early. So I got sent back in, my leave started in June, and they sent me back, like, the last week of May. So I had roughly, like, a week and a half of time that I could try and get all my medical checkups, getting ready to get out, get all my paperwork filled out, my dental visits, get all my stuff packed, get all everything shipped that I needed, which was just absolute chaos. Like, it was so stressful to try and deal with all that. So anyways, like, they flew me from, made a port visit in Bahrain, and we left, like, originally from Hawaii. So rather than flying me east, they fly everyone west. So I actually completely circled the world. So on my flight home, I went from Bahrain to, Cyprus, Greece, to Crete, to Portugal, to Norfolk, to Chicago, to Honolulu in about a day and a half. It was pretty long. Anyways, I flew in, I think it was like a Sunday, and then I had to report to like a temporary duty station on Monday morning at 7. So I was not really fully coherent Monday morning. I still had some serious jet lag going from like the 12 time zones that I flew across. But so you get there, and like the transition, like the TAPS program I took before I actually left on that deployment, which I was fortunate enough to do. And then from there, I got everything shipped and all my medical appointments done. When I came back, they were really kind of like out of the picture, like the military. I was technically on leave. I could get on bases, but there's really not many naval bases around here. Great Lakes does have some, but they're not going to provide a lot of the services. You're just kind of by yourself. So they try and give you some resources, and one of the best resources that I kind of came across was the local county veteran service office, which in Wisconsin we have one for every single county. And what the veteran service officers do are it's mandated that they're prior military members, I believe. And from there, they actually will help you file claims to the VA. But they can tell you all the benefits you have, and they help file all my paperwork for like my education benefits. So I didn't really have to worry about that myself. Like, they knew how to properly file it, so I only had to do it once, rather than doing it myself, where if you don't fill out one line item, it gets sent back to you and go from there. So that was one of the biggest organizations for helping. I know like the Disabled American Veterans has resources. American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, VFW, all have different resources as well. And even on campuses, a lot of campuses have their own resources. So like Madison here, we have the Vets for Vets organization, which can provide informational materials to veterans if they have questions on certain things, and we can kind of point them in the right direction. And also some other campuses even have similar things to that. And they also have like VITAL program, which is funded by the VA. They help people file like medical things, like getting enrolled with the VA health system and stuff, so that way you can get care there if you need to. So I don't know if there's any more you want me to elaborate on with that one. It's not an easy transition, and I wish there'd be more people that would help you along the way. You just kind of have to just kind of claw your way through a lot of walls. Some people have it really easy, other people don't. I mean, some of these people that run right to their last day, I don't know how they do it. Because if you are discharged from the military and you don't have a valid ID, you can't get on base. And if you're discharged out, you don't get certain base privileges. So like for writing resumes and stuff, so you're kind of SOL. And if you don't plan ahead, you're really shooting yourself in the foot. So, I mean, you really have to have some foresight in applying for, like, colleges and stuff, so that way you're not just getting out and, like, well, what do I do now? And then you get that whole boredom and just kind of, like, the whole stress of, well, how am I going to pay for all this stuff? And if you have a family, it's even worse. So, but there are other, the VA and some of these other places, they do offer assistance, and they see that that's a needed issue that needs to be addressed, and they really are working at trying to get it better and help people with like the transition programs. And there's even some nonprofits that have really stepped up and ran with it, like the Wounded Warrior Project and the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, or AIVA for short. You also have like Dry Hooch here in Madison, which they have veterans that are inside there and more than willing to help out. Like, you just have to ask questions, and most of these guys have gone through this stuff at one point or another. So you can just ask them, and they'll give you so much resources, and some guys will even just drive you where you need to go and show you exactly what you need to do, which is just super helpful.
All right, maybe going along those lines, are you using any of the bills that are currently out, like the new GI Bill that was just passed a few years ago, or any of the others?
Yeah, I'm actually using the Chapter 33, which is called the Post 9/11 GI Bill. That was passed, I think, in 2004. Before that, when I was in boot camp and everything, it was an option if you wanted the GI Bill in general, which was called just the Montgomery GI Bill. I think it's called Chapter 30, if I remember correctly. And that one was you chip in $100 each month for 1 year, and when you get out, you can reap some benefits. Like, they'll give you maybe $1,100 each month up to like $30,000. So it wouldn't essentially completely offset your college costs, but it would help out quite a bit. There are also things like you could do, like boosters, they call it, where you could chip in more money and the military would match it, so that way you'd have more money in the end. But back in 2004, they came with this post 9/11 GI Bill, which essentially put, you could still use the Montgomery GI Bill if you wanted, but you had to choose one or the other. Like, so for me, it was so much more cost effective to use a post 9/11, which pays for schooling, gives you a monthly housing allowance, and also gives you $1,000 a year for books. So it's an absolute fantastic benefit, and people, like, there's a lot of people that are using it now. And I mean, someone like myself, it's pretty much paying for my schooling, and one of the reasons I did join the military was to pay for school, because I couldn't afford it otherwise. So it really is great, and it's one of those things that I'm really happy it's here, and hopefully it can stay around for a while. I know there's a lot of people that are opposed to it just because all the upfront cost. But I mean, if you look at World War II, when they originated with the GI Bill, there's studies that show that it reaped between 2 and 8 times the benefit of what we paid into it, just based off people getting employment and paying taxes back over the time. And that was so much more people that used it back in World War II, because the whole military was a lot larger. So it's one of those things that it's a great recruiting tool. People can use it for advertising, like if you want free education, you can go to the military, and some of these people that come from less wealthy families and some really rough areas, they're essentially getting themselves set for college. And even if they don't use it for themselves, you can actually transfer it to children if you've been in for so many years. So some of these guys that have been in for 15 years that might have already gotten their degree while on active duty, they can pass it along to their wife or their children. So, but yes, I am using the post 9/11 GI Bill.
All right. I mean, is there like just anything else that, you know, comes to mind when you think about that you'd be willing to talk about? Or,
well, I mean, right now we have the Wisconsin GI Bill, which is separate from the post 9/11 GI Bill. It originated, Governor Doyle actually is the one that signed it into law, and that one paid for 128 credits of schooling from any UW institute. So that one was meant to go kind of hand-in-hand with the Montgomery GI Bill, which those ones were, they were able to use them together at the same time. So that way Wisconsin veterans that had residency, there's a lot of criteria for it, but if you're a resident at the time of service and when you get out, you qualify for the Wisconsin GI Bill if you have so much active duty time. So from there, you could use that to pay for your schooling would be offset, and you could use the Montgomery GI Bill as like a housing allowance. So when the post 9/11 came around, you had to either choose the Montgomery or the post 9/11, which kind of did all that in general. So they still have the Wisconsin GI Bill, but Governor Doyle put in a little clause at the time, I think it was 2010, because I just started schooling of it, where when I was using my post 9/11 right when I started, it was actually deducting from my Wisconsin GI Bill as well, even though I wasn't using that benefit. So it kind of, even though they're separate, they were still being used as one, So it kind of, it was counterintuitive because it pushed a lot of veterans out of the state for schooling, because I could go to Minnesota, use my post 9/11 GI Bill there, because there's no criteria locking me just in Wisconsin for it, and I could come back and get my Wisconsin GI Bill for my master's degree, which some people were doing, which is kind of, it's not beating the system, but it's just it, how the laws were written, it was smart for the veteran to do that because they could pay for their master's program, where otherwise, if, because most of the time you need a master's program now to really get really good jobs in the workforce because it's so competitive and with the economy. So now they have it where Governor Walker, actually when he got elected, did away with that clause. And they're looking of actually opening up the Wisconsin GI Bill to a lot more people. They're looking to change, like in the, his new budget proposal this year in 2013, he proposed that they take away with the restrictions that you have to be a Wisconsin resident when you joined or when you got out. So if you actually have residency and you've been here for 5 years and been paying taxes and stuff, you can actually qualify for Wisconsin GI Bill that way. So they're trying to get that benefit out there so more veterans go to school and more people just continue their education. And Wisconsin is actually a really good state for helping veterans out. I mean, they really do a lot with it. And some states, like Texas and that, they do a lot really as well. But you don't have to pay any state taxes for it. So like for me, when I was stationed overseas, I still had to pay a Wisconsin residency tax, so which was kind of, it was frustrating because I came back here twice a year for about 12 days, but I still had to pay state taxes for it. But you know, it is what it is, and I knew that they had the Wisconsin GI Bill at the time, so that's one reason that I kept my residency here, and I didn't really worry about switching it because I was like, well, I can, I know in the end I'll hopefully reap some of the benefits of keeping my residency here in the state.
I personally don't really have any more questions, so if there was just like any topic that came up or you thought of that you'd like to share.
Sure. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff with the military. I mean, if I can go in more detail, like for like our deployments or like just kind of what the whole aspect of my ship was, like the purpose of it, what we did. I mean, there's a lot of different initiations that you kind of go through. Like you have like the crossing the line, or they call it the polywog to shellback ceremony, which if you didn't cross the equator, you didn't go through initiation, you're considered a polywog. And if you do cross and you do the ceremony, you're a shellback. So, and a golden shellback is someone that crosses the equator at the international date line. So those are some criteria, and that started all the way back in like World War II. So I was fortunate where I went through the ceremony. First time I went through it, and the second time I was able to kind of administer it. So I wasn't really out on the whole ship doing it, because I was kind of stuck doing my job internally. But it was it's interesting. It builds a lot of character, and it's meant to bring people together. It's optional. You don't have to do it, but you get a nice big certificate, and they make you prove that you were a shellback. Like if I went to a different ship, if I did not have my ID card on me showing that I was that and it was signed, they'd make me go through that initiation again, which is kind of funny. But it's just a whole bunch of things that I put into it. Like you have like King Neptune, who one of the guy is imitating, and then you have like can't think of the guy that, like, they have him in Pirates of the Caribbean. He's one of the head pirates. Davy Jones. Mm-hmm. So you have Davy Jones, and you have a couple other things. And way back when, they used to have the Royal Baby, which was like a guy dressed up like a big baby, and you had to like kiss his belly for good luck. And it was World War II stuff was really like they. It was really a lot different than what they have now. Like now you have to tame everything down. You can't really do the royal baby anymore because it's considered hazing, which it is. In World War II, you could do that, and they'd have like the gauntlet where people would go through like kind of like a trash thing where they just throw eggshells in and stuff. And you had to crawl through it, and then at the very end, they'd like hose you down. So kind of like you're cleansing of it, and then like you're now a shellback, so now you're better than that. But it was just meant because the deployments way back when were so tough, and it was really meant to kind of bring people together and kind of give them some type of bond that they could use to their benefit to really kind of just help them get through some of their tough times. So now they still do it because it's a tradition, but it's not, our deployments aren't nearly as rough as what they had it back in World War II. But it's still kind of cool because you'll talk with some of the old timers, like from Vietnam and just from all types of eras, and a lot of the naval traditions are still the same, and they'll start talking about stuff and they'll give other people crap because they're still a polywog and they never went through their initiation or they never had that option to do it, and they always look down at them. They just give them tons of garbage about it. But if I were to walk in there, it's like, oh yeah, I have that, and show them my ID card, like they'd buy me a beer. It's just like, it's just friendly stuff, but it's pretty cool. And that's one of the things with the Navy is the rankings and the pay grades from pretty much all different types of navies transfer over. Like admirals are universal. That's like one of your highest officers for the Navy. If you have a British person, they have stars on their shoulder boards and stuff, you know it's an admiral. Like same thing with ours, and like the French and like the Indonesian Navy and the Thai Navy and stuff. It's very universal with that, where the Army and some of these other branches, they don't have that bonding. And because most of it stems from either the Portuguese or the British Navy, because those were the two prominent ones during the 15th, 16th century. And that's where a lot of the customs kind of originated from. So, but yeah, it's kind of cool. I mean, you just talk with some of these guys and they go way back with some of the stuff that they had on board, and they always love hearing stories of like what we have now. And I'm always just fascinated hearing what those guys did way back when, because they just, to me, I always look up to them. I mean, some of those guys that went through World War II on those ships, like they have my utmost respect. And it's just, it's interesting, and it's almost intimidating when you go into these places where they're all around. And I mean, there's unfortunately not as many of them right now because they're dying off at a pretty substantial rate. But you go into these like VFW posts and they want to hear your stories. And it's like, I don't really have that many stories. Like, I want to hear your stories. Like, you guys actually like went out there and did everything to a purpose, and you guys are the reason we are what we are right now. And they're just like, no, like what are you guys doing for this? Or how's this happen? Or what are you guys doing now with this? And it's just, it's so cool. I mean, you get such a good feeling when you talk with these guys, and it's just one of those ones, it's hard to explain if you're not in the military, but once you are and you put on that uniform and everything, you really do have a bond with all these other guys. And I mean, doesn't matter who you talk to, if they served and you served, chances are you'll find something to relate. And most people would think you're just crazy, but it's just one of those ones that you give such a sacrifice. I mean, for me, I was away from my family for 5 years and pretty much lost all the sanity when you're out at sea for 40 days straight, not seeing any type of land. But I mean, it's just all character building, as we call it. So I mean, these other guys that were in World War II, that were in like Vietnam and stuff, like they lost people all around them, and like that was their sacrifice and being away and everything. And some of these guys in Korea, and doesn't matter what war it was, like you just have that respect for these other people. And it's really nice to see now with today's culture where the veterans are kind of embraced, and they're kind of not really looked up to, but they just, people respect them and they really appreciate for all the stuff that they've done, because it is a volunteer force. And that's why a lot of the guys with Vietnam and stuff, I personally will go there and thank them every time I see someone from Vietnam, because I mean, for the treatment that they got when they came back, there's no reason for it, because these guys, they're drafted into it. It wasn't even like it was their choice, many of them. So it's like, to hold that against them, I mean, you criticize the people that went into the military because that's what the country asked of them, but you praise these people that ran away, like they fled up to Canada or something. So that's one thing that it kind of eats at me. But it's nice to see how the culture has kind of changed now. And they're really, like, I personally haven't witnessed anyone that's given me a hard time for being a veteran. I think it's because where I live and everything, but it's really nice kind of walking around and you talk to people, and I still don't know how to really respond when people like, well, thank you for your service. I always want to say thank you for your support, but you're better off just saying you're welcome and just kind of keeping at that, because it's, to me, I'm very humble, and there's also a lot of guys that have the same thing, or it's just like you just don't know how to take it, because I don't know, it's interesting to me. So what other stuff did you want me?
You've answered all my questions, so it's just like, you know, if there was anything that you just simply wanted to talk about.
Well, I mean, I will be doing also the vet museum one also, which has like more military history thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm not always good at just coming up with random things to talk about. I mean, I can talk and talk and talk, but I need kind of like key things to trigger on with it. So, but all your questions you have for the, we're all good on that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I guess we can wrap it up. Thanks for the interview.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for your time.
Yeah.